Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity who are living on the planet Earth, listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, and your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Monday on this final day of February 29th, 2016. I'm very excited about today's interview because a lot of my listeners are excited about it. They're the ones that told me you've got to get John R. Lott Jr. on your program. John R. Lott Jr. wrote More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, and he is going to be our first guest today. In fact, one of the pastors strongly urged me to get John on the program is a pastor in Oregon who I interviewed not long after, in fact, the day after that horrible shooting that took place in Oregon not long ago. And unfortunately, the media and the liberals and even some so-called Republicans and neoconservatives all begin to shout about the gun ownership being the problem behind these things. Well, our guest today certainly does not believe that. John R. Lott Jr. is the author of 5 books, including...
8.
Oh, 8. Oh, this is an outdated bio. Including, "Are Predatory Commitments Credible? Who Should the Courts Believe?" And that is also published by University of Chicago Press as our book today, More Guns, Less Crime, that we're discussing, is also published by. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, John R. Lott Jr.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, and I would like to also introduce you to our co-host today, Reverend Buzz Taylor, who's been lately a frequent co-host on Iron Sharpens Iron. It's great to have you on the program today, Buzz.
Good to be back.
Let me just quickly describe the book. On its initial publication in 1998, John R. Lott's More Guns, Less Crime drew both lavish praise and heated criticism. More than a decade later, it continues to play a key role in ongoing arguments over gun control laws. Despite all the attacks by gun control advocates, no one has ever been able to refute Lott's simple, startling conclusion that more guns mean less crime. Relying on the most rigorously comprehensive data analysis ever conducted on crime statistics and right to carry laws, the book directly challenges common perceptions about the relationship of guns, crime, and violence. For this third edition, Lott draws on an additional 10 years of data, including provocative analysis of the effects of gun bans in Chicago and Washington, D.C., that brings the book fully up to date and further bolsters its central connection. And I'd like to just read a quick blurb from John O. McGinnis of the National Review. "By providing strong empirical evidence that yet another liberal policy is a cause of the very evil it purports to cure, he," John R. Lott Jr., "has permanently changed the terms of debate on gun control, a model of the meticulous application of economics and statistics to law and policy." And that was, as I said, John O. McGinnis, National Review. Well, first of all, John, how do you go about researching where you have come to the conclusion that more guns is equivalent to less crime? How do you go about doing the research on something like that?
together a lot of different types of data. This, as you were reading, this, these are the largest studies that have been done on crime. So, for example, data for all the counties in the United States by year from 1977 through 2005. And I have, in the third edition, I have data for cities, all the cities in the United States, by year over the period, and also at the state level. You try to account for many different types of gun control laws. I guess there's 13 different types of ones that we look at. Arrest rates, conviction rates, prison sentence lengths, demographics, income poverty measures, lots of different things that may affect crime rates, and to try to see what happens. And, for example, more people have concealed handgun permits. What happens to crime rates? And what you find is that just as people can deter criminals with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates by the police, the fact that would-be victims might be able to defend themselves can also deter criminals.
And how do you address the victims and the benefits from protection?
Well, when people own guns, there are a couple of things that can happen. One is you can deter criminals from attacking, but you can, for those criminals who do attack, the fact that a victim has a gun turns out to be the, by far the safest course of action. There's something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, which has been around for about 40 years. And what it does is surveys about 100,000 people each year, of which about 5,000 or so are victims of violent crime. And it asks them, you know, what type of crime did a criminal try to commit? How did you respond? Was the criminal armed or not armed? Where did it take place? For the different types of responses that the victim took. And then they look at whether serious injury occurred to the victim or somebody that you were with was killed or injured. And so you can break it down finally to see what's the safest course of action for people to take. And what you find consistently, primarily for people who are relatively weaker physically, women, the elderly, having a gun is by far the safest course of action. Women, for example, who behave passively are about 2.4 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a woman who has a gun.
Yeah, it is ironic that liberals who tend to be feminists are so much in favor in the vast numbers of very strict gun control laws. I mean, some obviously would wish to ban all private gun ownership, and yet women are probably going to be among the greatest victims of gun crime, at least those that are...
Of crime. Look, I mean, there are two groups of people who benefit the most. The people who are most likely to be victims of crime, and that overwhelming tends to be poor blacks who live in high crime urban areas, and people who are relatively weaker physically, women and the elderly. And so I would argue it's basically the most vulnerable people in our society who benefit the most from having the option to be able to go and protect themselves.
Yes, and now obviously whenever one of these horrific crimes is headlining in the news about a school or a convenience store or fast food restaurant or a post office or whatever the situation is where you have numerous people shot by crazed gunmen, they always talk about how private gun ownership and soft gun control laws are what gives rise to these things. Now, are these acts, these horrific crimes that we all hear about, to your knowledge, committed by people who are owning legal guns and who are, purchased guns through normal circumstances and legal means?
Well, that depends, but not always. But the one common feature that you see in these mass public shootings is that they keep on occurring time after time in places where people aren't allowed to have guns for protection. If you look at news since 1950, with just three exceptions, every single one of the mass public shootings in the United States have taken place where where general citizens are allowed to have guns for protection. And what's clear is how these killers, time after time, take that into consideration. These killers, these mass public shooters in the United States, they're trying to commit suicide, but they want to do so in a way that's going to get them attention. They know that the more people that they can kill or injure, the more attention that they're going to be able to get. So, for example, you know, just one example, you look at the Newtown killer. He had collected data on mass public shootings over a few decade period of time, had collected the number of people killed or injured in each attack, and gone back and found the amount of news coverage on each of those attacks. And then he had graphed it out, showing that the attacks that had gotten the most people killed had gotten the most news attention. And according to police, he wanted to go and kill more people than were killed in the Norway attack, which up until the Paris attack held the record for the most people killed or injured in a mass public shooting in Europe or the United States. And, you know, because he wanted to get more worldwide attention than even the Norway killer had received. It's chilling to go through and read the diaries or listen to other documents that these individuals leave about how explicit they are about trying to go to some place where nobody's going to be able to stop them for a while, because they know that that if they go to a place where victims are defenseless, they're going to be able to go and kill more people. And they know, and how chilling it is to hear them say that if they can go to a place where people can't defend themselves and they can kill more people, they'll get more media attention, because that's their goal. They want to commit suicide, but they want to do so in a way that will get them attention.
Well, I'm going to give our email address if anybody would like to join us on the air with a question of your own. Our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state of residence, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. Now, does your data that you are addressing in your book, is that only data that reflects upon the United States, or do you go into Europe and so on with these statistics?
It's primarily data from the United States, but we look at data from around the world. I mean, I'll give you one example, and that is every single time that guns have been banned any place in the world, not just in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, you see murder rates go up after the ban. You know, in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, the claim is, well, unless you ban guns over the entire country, criminals will still get guns from Maryland or Virginia or from the rest of Illinois. The problem is that may explain why crime rates didn't fall as much as gun control advocates were predicting when these laws were passed, but it surely doesn't explain why they increased so much after the bans went into place, because presumably people could go and get those guns from those other places to begin with. But the thing is, when you look around the world, even in entire nations, even in island nations, which you think would be the ideal experiment, there's no neighbor for them to go and blame, readily defined, easily defensible borders. And yet what you see in each of those cases where guns are banned, you see large increases in murder rates that occur right after the bans go into effect. And, you'd think at least one time, out of randomness, you'd see murder rates go down. But that hasn't been the case. They go up every single time. And, I think there's a simple explanation for that, and that is when you ban guns, it's the most law-abiding good citizens who obey the laws, and when you disarm the law-abiding good citizens, who are also criminals, you actually make it relatively easier for the criminals to go and commit crimes.
And we do have a listener in Great Neck, Long Island, New York, Robert, who asks, is it true that you, John, used to be an imbecile, I mean liberal, when it comes to gun control laws?
I'd say I was pretty much in the middle of the debate on this stuff. I surely didn't believe what I believe now. was probably as affected by everybody else as anybody else by the media coverage. I mean, when you constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns and never hear about the benefits, it has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. And even though I've been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission and done a lot of research on crime generally, I've never really been interested in the issue of guns. I just kind of backed into it. And, you know, I was surprised to see the large net benefits that people have. Look, there's one thing anybody who reads my research knows, and I find police are extremely important in stopping crime. I think police are the single most important factor in stopping crime. But one thing is clear is that the police themselves understand the limits to what they can do. They realize that even though they are important, they virtually always arrive on a crime scene after the crime's occurred.
Yeah.
And that raises the question, what should people do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? Police realize for their own lives how important guns are to them. And I think it's hard to find any other group in the population that's as supportive of private gun ownership as police officers are. You know, when you talk about mass public shootings, if you look at Police One, which is the largest private organization of police officers in the country with about 450,000 members, you know, you can find their surveys on our website at crimeresearch.org. You find that 80% of the police think that getting rid of these so-called gun-free zones, allowing people to be able to have their permanent concealed handguns with, will make a big difference in terms of stopping these types of attacks.
We do have another listener in Newville, Pennsylvania, Susan, who asks, do you believe that an American citizen should be able to purchase any type of weapon, and how would that affect the local police protection that you mentioned, where the citizens of a given community may be more powerfully armed than the local police?
Well, I don't think the citizens are more powerfully armed. You know,
I think that
there's lots of discussions about things like assault weapons, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And people seem to think that they're something different than they actually are. I mean, if you look at an assault weapon, at least the way it's defined in the media and what have you, is basically a semi-automatic rifle that functions identically to a semi-automatic hunting rifle. Fires the same bullets with the same rapidity, doing the same damage. In fact, you know, guns like the AR-15 or Bushmaster, those are similar to small caliber hunting rifles. You know, they're basically too small of a caliber to even be legally able to use to hunt deer in many states, because they're more likely to wound rather than kill the deer. But, you know, if you want to go and ban all semi-automatic weapons, you know, at least let's talk about that, but to try to go and ban some semi-automatic rifles based on how they look rather than how they function, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So, I mean, if she wants to be specific about the types of guns or whatever that she thinks should be banned, I'm happy to talk to.
Well, let me just ask you a question. If you could give me a list as brief as you want to give, or as lengthy as you want to give, what weapons do you believe should be banned, if any?
Well, I have absolutely no problem with people owning any type of semi-automatic weapon. People do in the United States own automatic weapons, but it's very heavily licensed, and there's no crimes that are committed with those guns. The crimes are committed with the semi-automatic weapons. But if, you know, if somebody wants to, she wants to point to some other types of gun, semi-automatic, whatever, that she thinks can be bad, I'm happy to talk about.
So are you saying then that you do believe that there is a limit in your opinion as to what guns an American citizen should be legally able to own?
Well, if they're really is. All I can tell you is I do empirical work. I look at what guns people can own. Now, I don't have data on what they might possibly be able to own. And at least in the range of guns that people can legally own, which are, you can see rules changing, semi-automatic weapons, I don't see any evidence that any changes in the types of semi-automatic weapons that people are able to own has any bad impact on crime rates.
Yeah. Well, I was actually asking about your personal opinion on that, what you thought, but
I don't have personal opinions on this type of stuff. I just try to look to see what the data shows on them.
I see. Mm. And now, what is the most typical weapon that is used in committing deadly crime in the United States?
Basically, a handgun, something like. Handgun, a pistol.
Mm-hmm. And what areas in the United States are the freest and loosest when it comes to gun control laws?
Well, I suppose you have a lot of the western states, a lot of the south. It's basically, as far as gun control goes, the strict gun control states are basically California, New York, mm-hmm. New Jersey, Maryland, those states around there, D.C., obviously. That's where you see by far the strictest gun control. Most of the rest of the country is relatively liberal. I mean, there's variations that you see on it. But, for example, there's 10 states now that you can carry concealed handguns without a permit. It's basically Alaska, Arizona, Wyoming, Arkansas, Mississippi, Maine, Vermont, and then there are two states where you can carry in virtually all the states without a permit. And that's Idaho and Montana, like 99.4% of the state. In those two states, you can carry without a permit. So, I mean, that's just one example. But, there you have states from the west to the south to the north.
And why is it that this seems to be, I mean, it seems to be, as even the book cover has described it, as a very simple and almost like a no-brainer conclusion that you've drawn. Yeah, if more people have guns in a certain area, people are going to be more afraid to commit a crime in that area because they don't want to get killed themselves. But why is this such, it seems such a secret or something that is not even addressed when Republicans and so-called conservatives are standing behind podiums talking about gun rights?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you have a lot of people, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, some others like that, Carla Fiorina, others, Ben Carson, I think have done a good job of explaining the reasoning that's involved here. I mean, when I go and debate, sometimes one of the simple questions I ask is, if, God forbid, somebody was stalking you or threatening you or your family, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your house that says your home is gun-free zone? And I never run into anybody that I'm debating that would say that. I think in part they won't say that because they know it's not going to be credible with the audience. They realize that if they say that, sure, I'll put a sign like that, they lose credibility. So even the strictest gun control proponents. And there's a simple reason for that. And that is, if you were to actually put a sign like that in front of your home, they realize it would be a bad thing for criminals. That they would view that, it's not like they're saying, oh, I'm not allowed to bring my gun in, so I won't attack. Instead, they'll think to themselves, this is an easy target. This is what I'm going to go after. And that's what you see time after time, whether it be, just last month, there was almost an attack at one of the largest churches.
Right.
Nicely sympathizer.
his father, fortunately, had realized that there was something wrong with his son, and he contacted the FBI, and the FBI put a watcher on him, and found that he was plotting to attack one of the largest churches. One of the reasons that he gave was that he said there are a lot of people there, you'll get a lot of coverage, and nobody else there is allowed to have a gun, so it'll be very easy to go and attack people and kill them without them being able to stop them from doing the attack. But you see this time after time. You look at last year, the Charleston shooting, or when the diary came out last year from the Batman movie studio. Similar types of things came out. The first target for the Charleston shooter was supposed to be Charleston College. It was one of the looked into it and realized that the security that they had there, he decided to go after the church where he knew that there'd be nobody there to go and stop him. In the Batman movie, in the diary that he put out, his first target was going to be an airport, but he found that there'd be too much security there and they would kill him before he was able to go and kill his victims. Even when he was picking movie theaters, there were 7 movie theaters that were within a 20-minute drive of his apartment. Only one of those movie theaters posted signs banning from a concealed handgun. He didn't go to the movie theater closest to his home. He didn't go to the one that advertised itself prominently as having the largest auditoriums in the state of Colorado. Instead, he went to the only one where he knew victims were able to defend themselves. And I can go through cases from the previous year, like the Santa Barbara shoot, or in Canada, the New Brunswick attack, where again, these killers understood that they wanted to try to go and find venues where people wouldn't be able to stop them from doing their attack.
And by the way, I want to let our listeners that wrote in with questions, Robert in Great Neck, New York, Susan in Newville, Pennsylvania, you're getting free copies of this book, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, compliments of University of Chicago Press. We do have an anonymous listener in Alabama who says that he asked a pastor he knows if he packed a gun, and the pastor said absolutely. And when he said to asked the pastor if someone began shooting from the outside of your congregation, an intruder came in and began shooting in your church, what would you do? And the pastor said, "I'd duck." And the anonymous listener said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Because I don't want to be hit by the crossfire of everybody else in the church shooting the criminal."
Yeah.
But I'd like you to...
Well, you know what? Just one last comment on that. That is, if you go to our website at crimeresearch.org, you'll find we have dozens of cases of mass public shootings that have been stopped by citizens with permanent concealed handguns.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the concerns that's often voiced is, well, why don't you accidentally shoot a bystander? The thing is, if I look through these cases, and there's not one single case where a bystander has been accidentally shot by a permit holder. The other concern that's raised is, well, when the police arrive on the scene, don't they go and accidentally shoot the permit holder? And that's never occurred either. So while those types of concerns are possible, I would just say it's not something that we actually observe happening.
And I know that you also have a blog site that is John R.
CrimeResearch.org for the Crime Prevention Research Center that can go and find a lot of stuff that we've been talking about and a lot more at the website at CrimeResearch.org.
CrimeResearch.org. Do you still have johnrlott.blogspot.com?
Yeah, I would just go to CrimeResearch.org.
CrimeResearch.org. And for our New York listeners, and we have many of them, the New York City Junto is having a debate featuring our guest, John R. Lott, on this very issue. Can you say anything about the individual you'll be debating at this event?
I can't remember.
Okay, that's all right. For more details, if you'd like to attend that event, go to nycjunto.org. That's NYC, J-U-N, as in Nancy, T as in Thomas, O.org, /upcoming-speakers, nycjunto.org/upcoming-speakers. I want to thank you so much, Mr. Lott, for being on the program, and I hope that you return to our program in the near future.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Well, thank you very much. And when we come back from our break, we're going to have another guest to continue the thread of this broadcast, this theme, Dr. Ron Gleason of Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California. So we're going to be talking about God and Guns, a Christian's Right and Duty to Protect Self and Family. So we hope you don't go away. And we still have some more books to give away by Dr. John or Mr. John R. Lott, More Guns, Less Crime. So we have a limited number, so though I would advise you email us as soon as you can with your questions if you care to receive a book. And this book offer is only available for our United States listeners. But we'll be right back with Dr. Ron Gleason and more on the same subject after these messages.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750. That's 508-528-5750. Or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org. That's ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org. Or even on SermonAudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Thrivent Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
Finances and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned us in, for the first half hour of the program, we had as our guest John R. Lott Jr. We were discussing his book, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime Law, Crime and Gun Control Laws. And now we have the honor and privilege of having our second guest join us for the next 90 minutes. And his name is Dr. Ron Gleason, and he is the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California, which is a member of the PCA, or the Presbyterian Church in America. And he is going to be talking about our theme, God and Guns, A Christian's Right and Duty to Protect Self and Family. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Dr. Ron Gleason.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's an honor to be with you.
And before we get into the topic at hand, I would like you to describe for our listeners Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California.
Yorba Linda is a conservative Presbyterian church. We make use of the ordinary means of grace, that is, the preaching of the word, the proper administration of the sacraments, prayer, and Christian fellowship. We are, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, we are traditional conservative, and our worship reflects that. We adhere to what we call the regulative principle, which means that we strive to worship only in the way that God has prescribed in His Word. So we don't have any track lighting, although I'm trying to get a fog machine out. Really would like to have one of those, but so it's just very straightforward, preaching the word. I preach through books of the Bible, and for those who are interested, they can find all of my sermons and the sermons of my assistant pastor at one word here, gracepresbyterian.net.
That's gracepresbyterian.net. And just to give you a little bit more information about our guest, Dr. Ron Gleason is married with 6 children. After graduating from the Citadel Military College of South Carolina, he served 3 years in the Army as a tank platoon leader. Soon thereafter, he completed a Master's of Divinity degree at Gordon-Conwell Seminary and a doctor's degree at the Free University of Amsterdam. He then pastored churches in Holland and Canada, worked with Ligonier Ministries in Toronto, and after moving to California in 1994, completed his PhD from Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, and we have had the current president of that seminary, Peter Lilbeck, on our program in the not-so-distant past. And you've also written a book that we hope to get you back on the air next week, in fact, next Monday on the 7th of March, on the death penalty. Tell us something about that book that you've written.
Well, that was a book, one of the projects that I have in mind. My work in Holland was in the area of Christian ethics, and my PhD at Westminster in Philadelphia was in systematic and historical theology. And as a pastor of basically 35 years in 3 foreign countries, Holland and Canada and Southern California, which is the most foreign country I've been in. I had this keen burning desire to put into the hands of the man and the woman in the pew simple ethical commentaries on issues that are prevalent in our day and age. I have written some workbooks on homosexuality, basically called What Homosexuals Do, A Parent Speaks Out. And I wrote that as a wrestling coach and as a parent and as a pastor. And the death penalty book came about because a number of people were questioning whether it was right for Christians to be in favor of the death penalty. And so what I decided to do was to write the book and to provide as much biblical material as I could to try to convince people that indeed, because of texts such as Genesis 9 and the whole idea of man being created in the image of God, that when a person takes another person's life intentionally, there are words in the Hebrew language that speak about murder. And that really is the correct translation of the sixth commandment. You shall not murder, not you shall not kill, because what I say in the book, and Lord willing, we'll talk more about this this coming Monday, is that all murder involves the killing of a person, but not all killing is, in fact, murder. There, in other words, there are legitimate means by which, so for example, law enforcement or our military personnel or even a private citizen can protect him or herself and not be guilty of murder.
And the title of that book again?
It's called The Death Penalty on Trial.
Death Penalty on Trial. The Death Penalty on Trial. And we're going to be, God willing, discussing that for 2 hours this coming Monday, March 7th, from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern. And now let me have the privilege of introducing you, Ron, to my co-host, a fellow PCA-er.
Well put.
a Presbyterian brother in Christ who is a member of a PCA congregation locally here in Carlisle. Let me introduce you to the Reverend Buzz Taylor.
Hello. Good to meet you.
Buzz, great to meet you, brother.
And I have been seriously looking forward to the subject today. It really strikes a nerve. It's one I've been interested in for years.
And Buzz is a proud gun owner.
Gun owner, yes, I am a gun owner.
And Buzz has had quite a journey theologically, from fundamentalist Baptist to charismatic to Pentecostal to Church of God, Findlay, Ohio, to now theologically reformed and Presbyterian.
Took me a long time to arrive.
Unfortunately, he leaped over Reformed Baptist, which I am particularly a Reformed Baptist, but I forgive him for that.
I'm sure the forgiveness is mutual.
Now you're actually writing a book on the subject that we are discussing. It's not in print yet, but you're in the process of writing it, correct?
That is correct. As I'm looking at the manuscript right now, including the bibliography, it's about 280 pages. Mm-hmm. May I just give you a kind of an outline of what the book was?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. I was asked by a number of good friends of mine at various times and at various locations if I would be willing to do something like this. And it's been a bit of a consternation to me that more of my conservative Presbyterian and Reformed friends and ethicists have not been willing to touch this. And I don't think there's any shame involved in this. In fact, as I began the study, I found it not only to be fascinating for myself, but I found that there were a number of law professors, many of them non-believing as far as I know, that were willing to help me with this and were fascinated by the idea that a pastor would even consider this. Yeah. So, Buzz, you and I are in a unique
company. Yes, yes.
So I began by just asking, why is this necessary? And one of the reasons why I think it's necessary is that for so many, it seems that pacifism is the default setting for Christians. That I've even talked with fellow PCA pastors who have explained to me that if they heard something that went bump in the night, and they found that there was someone in their house and they had done harm to their children, they wouldn't do anything except call 911 and pray. And I found that difficult to swallow for myself. I think it's a bit ivory tower. I think in reality, when the event presents itself to us, that all of the ivory tower stuff just falls away. And and then you begin to, you know, the whole idea of the will to live and to the will to protect your wife and your family, that kicks in, and I think it kicks in with a vengeance. At least I hope it would. And so I decided that to write what I consider to be, in the very first place, a common sense commentary on guns and gun ownership. And at the same time, because I'm a Christian ethicist, I take of the 9 chapters in the book, 2 lengthy chapters are devoted to what does the Bible say about this. So I asked the question, how do we get where we are? And then I looked at some of the things that probably John talked about in the previous section, where we had the Gun Control Act of 1968, and there were people on that committee, which I thought was fascinating when I began to study it. It was Orrin Hatch and Bob Dole, Ted Kennedy, Arlen Specter, and Joe Biden. The Gun Control Act came out in 1968, and just to show the efficiency of our government, they finally published their report in 1982. But here's what they said. I thought this was fascinating. In February of 1982, that committee said this: the conclusion is thus inescapable that the history, concept, and wording of the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, as well as its interpretation by every major commentator in the first half of the century after its ratification, indicates that what is protected is an individual right of a private citizen to own and carry firearms in a peaceful manner.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have, I think, devolved from that point. But so I go from there to chapter two, where I was helped by a man, and I don't know if he still teaches at George Mason University. And his name is Nelson Lund, and he was very helpful, and he helped me to take the 27 words that we find in the Second Amendment and to parse them in a way that that he was convinced it was an individual right, and moreover, that it guaranteed the First Amendment. The Second Amendment is the guarantee of the First Amendment.
Yes.
So then I went into Chapter 3, where I talk about law enforcement, state constitutions, even some of the law enforcement officials that have really gone PC, and there are others who haven't. I think it's the Sheriff David Clark up in Wisconsin, who has just done wonderful work in favor of individual citizens being able to keep and bear arms. Then I did, in Chapter 4, a brief history of English and United States history on guns. And that was a fascinating chapter, too. And I remember that as I did that, there was a statement by Ben Franklin who said, "Make yourselves sheep and the wolves will eat you," which I thought was a very commonsensical statement. And then in Chapter 5, I asked the question, because that's a hotly debated issue, is what exactly was the understanding of the word militia by the English in history and mm-hmm. by the Founding Fathers?
That's obviously a primary point because of the fact that the Second Amendment it regards that.
It became very clear to me, increasingly clear as I went along, that the term militia was individual citizens, and depending upon who you read, that individual citizen that constituted the militia ranged in age from 14 to a little over 60. And then the chapters 6 and 7 were kind of a extended discourse on what Scripture actually teaches. And then in chapter 8, I make the point that conventional wisdom as we have it today isn't. It's not really conventional. It's not really wisdom. And then finally, I conclude with the whole idea of looking at the nations of Israel, Switzerland, and Japan, as because each of those
yes.
respective countries has some unique gun laws. And then I added an appendix, and it ended up being a kind of a back and forth I had with a fellow PCA pastor who's out in your area, and he was one of the ones who said that he would never ever do anything to prevent somebody from harming his family. He would just call 911, and I tried to explain to him that if that's the case, depending upon where you are, but I have in my congregation, I have two SWAT people, and they have told me that their best response time is probably 15 minutes. So that
yes.
means that all that law enforcement is going to do is clean up the mess and take a report.
Mm-hmm. Right. And by the way, I want to give our email address for those of you who'd like to join us on the air with a question. It's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen @gmail.com. And please give us your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you're outside of the USA. I do have a listener in Garden City, Long Island, New York, Brian, who says or asks, are Christians ever allowed to defend themselves or someone else from physical attack? If yes, does Scripture prohibit what tool we use to defend ourselves or others with?
Great question. Thanks for sending that in. I think that strikes at the heart of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I am convinced that the sixth commandment is the commandment that allows Christians to protect themselves. I look at that from the basic understanding of the sixth commandment in the Old Testament, and as well as in the creeds and confessions of the Christian church, that we are to avoid doing harm to ourselves and others, and that we are to defend ourselves and our property and our loved ones. Does it prohibit? No. It doesn't. When Cain slew Abel in Genesis, I don't know what kind of object he used. I don't know if he strangled his brother. I don't know if he hit him with a rock or with a stick or whatever he did. But whatever it was, God did not prohibit those implements immediately after Cain slew Abel. So he said, okay, we're banning all rocks. Nobody can carry rocks anymore. I really believe that, but to make it very concrete, and again, we come down to the practical aspect of it. If we're dealing with something that goes bump in the night in our house, if you are not very, very, very good at hand-to-hand combat, I wouldn't recommend it, because typically what I have found in situations like that, both in the military and in civilian life, is that in those kinds of very intense situations, your gross motor activity drops to almost zero. And your fine motor is even less, if possible. And so what happens is you get this adrenaline rush, and to go out and to try to do hand-to-hand combat in the dark with somebody that you don't know whether they're armed or not, or whether they are much bigger than you or much more competent at hand-to-hand combat, I wouldn't advise. Certain non-lethal approaches, such as pepper spray. Pepper spray can be effective only if you are in very close proximity to your assailant, only if there is no wind blowing, because if the wind is blowing towards you and you spray the person who's attempting to assail you, that spray is going to come right back in your face, and you're going to be the one blinded and gagging for the moment. So in general, what I would say, if there's something that goes bump in the night in your house, you know your house better than the intruder knows your house, and probably my weapon of choice would be a handgun.
And by the way, Brian, you're getting a free copy of John R. Lott Jr.'s book, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws. I know.
Enjoy that, Brian. It's a great book.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I feel confident to give it away during your interview, even though you didn't write the book, is because I know that you highly recommend the book. And perhaps we'll have, in fact, I know that your publisher for the death penalty book said they're shipping out books to give away next week for our listeners. So,
oh, excellent.
So our listeners should mark that down on their calendars. Buzz, Reverend Buzz.
Yes. Of course, the subject of the Second Amendment has already been brought up. And just to give you some idea, the extent that people will go at to eliminate it, and I wish I had the documentation on this. I lost it years ago. But back in the 80s, I believe it was, early 80s, a school kid had dropped his history book in a snowbank out in front of my house. I took advantage of that and brought it in, and I was looking in the appendix, and they had a really nice color picture of the Bill of Rights, fancy printing and all that. And in the Bill of Rights, they had split the First Amendment in half and used the second half as the Second Amendment, and there was no Second Amendment of the right to keep and bear arms. So, I mean, here, I'm thinking we've got a generation now that is never even going to learn that they ever had the right to keep and bear arms.
Right. But I was doing volunteer wrestling coaching. I used to take the wrestlers and ask them to let me see their history books. And the last one I looked at, Buzz, there was a paragraph on George Washington and 7 pages on Marilyn Monroe.
Wow.
I mean, but this is, I mean, basically what we're discussing here is indoctrination and and textbooks that lie to the American people. That's a serious offense as far as I'm concerned. When you take something like you just described, where you take the First Amendment, you break it into 2, and eliminate the 2nd, that's deceit.
Oh, definitely, yes. It's like the late D. James Kennedy said, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion, but we're not entitled to the wrong facts.
Exactly. And so, I mean, when I talk to people who are opposed to gun ownership, my response, my rejoinder to them is, look, the Second Amendment doesn't say that you must go out and buy a gun. It simply says, as a law-abiding citizen, if you are so inclined, you may keep and bear arms. And so it gives you that option. For any and all who say to me, I don't want a gun, I say, that's fine. That, as far as I know, we're still living in a free country, and that's your choice. You do not have to buy a gun. But what is, I think, most detrimental is when you have people who say, I don't want a gun, and therefore you should not have one.
Yes, yes.
I am really of the opinion that if one of these people was in a situation and there was a bad guy with a gun, they would want a good guy with a gun.
Mm. We do have another listener, another Brian, this one not from New York, but this one from Gardner's, Pennsylvania. Brian writes in, how did this country go from pastors in the pulpit all but demanding, whoops, I just lost Brian's email here, I'm sorry about that, all but demanding gun ownership, all but demanding the men in their congregation to take up arms at the time of the American Revolution, to an almost sweeping anti-gun stance today. I guess Brian's question is assuming that most pastors are anti-gun. I don't know if that's correct or not. I'm sure most liberal pastors are, but if you could comment on that.
Sure. I mean, the short answer, obviously, is that there's a history involved. In the 17th century, early 17th century, in the state of Virginia, it was actually against the law not to bring your gun to church. And here's a little-known trivia fact. If a Virginian failed to bring his gun to church, he was fined 7 pounds of tobacco.
By the way, when our co-host Buzz was a pastor, he was very thankful that law was not in place anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So I think what has happened, and I just, you know, I mentioned earlier the Gun Control Act that started in the 1968. So if we begin to think about those halcyon days in the 1960s and the early 1970s, where this country was literally standing on its head. And there was so much going on. And the movement to the left was obvious and precipitous. And again, to come back to Buzz's point earlier, the whole notion of the deception in many of the books that our school children are using, I believe that it's safe to say now that much of what passes for public education is indoctrination. Mm-hmm. It really matters little what the ethical subject is. Mm-hmm. It's going to be way left of center. And then when you begin to, I'm concerned about Christians in public schools, because I know that can be very, very detrimental. And depending upon the stats that you read at any given time, there is something like a 50 up to a 75% attrition rate of Christians not coming out of high school intact. And And that's unacceptable attrition. And if you're on the battlefield and you've lost 50%, you're in deep weeds.
Right.
And then that other percentage that survives then goes where? To secular universities, where the attack is intensified, and the tenured professors, by and large, are very liberal. And the net result is that these strong Christian kids come out of university after having gone through the mill of high school and university, and it's a miracle. It's only by divine intervention that they're able to keep their faith intact. So what happens is, with regards to the guns in school, basically every authority figure that they come in contact with, they're telling them this is bad. And of course, by the time you go away to university, I realized that by my sophomore year at the Citadel, I reached my apogee of knowledge. I had just knew everything I needed to know, and I became convinced that my parents didn't know anything. And I questioned almost everything they had taught me when I was growing up. And so you have these tenured professors who have written books, and they have the jackets with the nice little patches on the elbows and all of that. And they come in, they sound very profound, and people get swayed, and they get swayed very, very easily. Plus, again, to Brian's point, what happens if you pay any attention to the newscast and anything else, virtually everybody you're going to hear or see is going to make some reference to how bad guns are. Every time there's a shooting, whether it's at Virginia Tech or whether it's Columbine, matters little, that there's always going to be a big hoot and cry. First thing you're going to hear is, we need more laws. We need more gun laws. And I think it's important to keep in mind for all of us that if every law we have on the books right now and every law that any legislator could conceive will never stop the problem of evil and sin.
Well, if you just look at what happened in evangelicalism, since we were talking about bringing guns to church, we have come to a place in evangelicalism where you're not even allowed to disagree with your opponent without repercussions, how much less to shoot an assailant.
Well, exactly. And, I mean, that is indicative, don't you think, of just how far we have devolved? I mean, if I see a campus, a college campus, for example, that wants to have a conservative speaker come and speak, and that conservative speaker gets shouted down or is not able to speak, I don't think that's tolerant at all.
No.
And I think tolerance ends basically when one side or the other gets the 51st percentile.
By the way, Brian in Gardner's, Pennsylvania, you too are getting a free copy of More Guns, Less Crime, by our first guest, John R. Lott, who was on previously, thanks to the generosity of the University of Chicago Press. We have to go to a break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. 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 I think we have a couple more books left. And these are only available for our United States listeners. I'm sorry, but our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, who ship out these free giveaways for us, cannot be stuck with an enormous overseas and Canadian shipping bill at the end of each month, because we give away a lot of books on Iron Sharpens Iron. So I hope that you who are in Canada and overseas can forgive us for that. But we still want to hear from you with your questions if you have them. And the email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with Dr. Ron Gleason on God and Guns.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions, like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, Find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity? Of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivent Financial. We're not your typical financial services provider. We're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps our nearly 2.4 million members be wise with money. We provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most. We help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivent story by contacting me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433. We know we were made for
so much more than ordinary life. Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story. We were made to
thrive. Welcome back. If you just tuned in, our guest right now is Dr. Ron Gleason, pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Yorba Linda, California. We are discussing God and guns, the Christian's right and duty to protect self and family. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And before we go on to our discussion, I'd like to know more about a couple of the other books that you've written. I know that you've written a biography of Herman Bovink, haven't you?
I have. We lived in the Netherlands for 10 years. We went over for me to start my study, and four of our six children were born there. And while I was studying, we liked it so much that we attempted and succeeded in becoming American pastors in the Dutch system. So I pastored a Dutch-speaking church near The Hague in a suburb of The Hague called Rijswijk. And so while I was there, I was doing a lot of study on Dr. Herman Bovink, who is absolutely one of my favorite theologians. He's up there with Henry Bullinger and with John Calvin and a number of others. And so I wrote doctoral dissertations on Bovink and his theology. And after I came back, someone suggested, well, you're the one to write the English biography. There is no English biography. Why don't you write one?
Mm.
And so I did. And it has sold well. It's a great read for all of your listeners. I recommend you give it for every event you can think of, anniversaries, birthdays, bar mitzvahs, whatever it is.
Groundhog Day.
Yeah, all of that. And give several copies. But it is, I trust, for anyone who wants to know good Reformed theology, that Bovink really ought to be one of the men that you read. The four-volume English version is now available through Baker Books in Grand Rapids. But if you don't want to take the outlay of cash and pay for all four volumes, there is recently an abridged one volume that was edited by Dr. John Bolt, who is at Calvin Seminary. And John has just done an excellent, excellent job in doing that. And then there is another volume
Bavinck wrote in 1909, he wrote a popular dogmatics, and it was called in Dutch the Magnalia Dei, or actually that's Latin, but that was the Dutch title, meaning the great things of God. And that book has been translated into English under the title Our Reasonable Faith. And one of the things that I have found that is most appealing in Bavinck is that he always speaks in concert with Scripture. And Bavinck taught systematic theology and ethics in a little village called Compton, where we lived, and that's where I got the interest in studying him. He taught there for 20 years, and then he went to the Free University of Amsterdam, where I studied, and he was the successor of Dr. Abraham Kuyper, and he taught systematic theology there until his death in 1921.
And the book on guns that you are writing, or you have the manuscript that hasn't been published, what's the title of that?
The tentative title is A Christian View of the Second Amendment, and it bears the subtitle of Should a Christian Keep and Bear Arms?
Great. And do you have a publisher yet?
Not yet. I'm looking for it, looking for one very soon. If you have any ideas, let me know.
Well, I obviously have to mention one of my sponsors, Solid Grand Christian Books. I will have them contact you, and maybe something will come of that.
That would be great.
They are faithful sponsors of Iron Sharpens Iron, and I thank God for them. And they have nothing but the finest and theologically reformed literature from the past and present, predominantly from the past, but they do have some very good contemporary writers. Solid-ground-books.com. I must give them a plug for their wonderful help to us. Solid-ground-books.com.
Tell him I'll be waiting with bated breath for their call.
Oh, great. I will.
All right.
And obviously you know that a man that I'm assuming we both mutually admire, and many people in the Reformed community greatly admire, John Piper.
Yes.
Of Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I don't know if he uses the exact term Reformed Baptist to describe himself, but he is a Baptist who happens to be in many areas theologically Reformed or Calvinistic.
Yes.
And he would disagree with most Reformed Baptists in that he holds to a continuist or non-cessationist position on the gifts.
Right.
And has other views that ruffle the feathers of those who are Reformed and Reformed Baptist. In fact, as much as he loves to bless Reformed Christians, I think he also loves to poke us with a sharp stick, because he very often will come up with things, and I mean I don't intend to insult our brother by saying that. In fact, the members of his congregation were kind enough to create the theme music to Iron Sharpens Iron that we use at the beginning. But he takes a pacifist position on this, and I'm not an expert on his view, but it seems that he believes that he would rather that he and his Christian family, who he is certain will be in heaven after death, he would rather they die and go to heaven than hasten the death of an evil intruder who is most likely unregenerate, and hasten their entrance into hell by killing them in defense of themselves. Now, is that an oversimplification of it, or is that...
I read with interest Dr. Piper's expose, and it literally caused a firestorm when he did it. And as much as I admire him, he and I will agree to disagree, I trust, on this issue. I have no desire to, from a human standpoint, attempt to hasten my family's entrance into heaven. I am blessed with a family that is believing, and I know that because God is sovereign, that God will take me, my wife, our children, our grandchildren, and our now almost four great-grandchildren to him when it is time. And that will be in his time and in his timing. And yet, at the same time, this same sovereign God gives me instruction. He gives me Torah. He gives me an infallible, inspired Bible that is meant
to walk me through all of these very difficult ethical issues. And part of that tells me I am to protect myself and I am to protect my family. The various commentaries that we have, again, on the sixth commandment are crystal clear that we are to be in the... We're to do all we can to protect ourselves and to protect our family and, if necessary, to protect our property. And for Dr. Piper to say something like that, I understand his position. I know there are many people like that. Most of them that I know that are like that are liberal, and I'm not saying that Dr. Piper is liberal by any stretch of the imagination. He is not a Jim Wallis. He's not a John Yoder. He's not any of these others that are just far out in the left. And even though he and I will disagree with the continuation of the gifts, I would disagree with Wayne Grudem on that, but I can certainly learn a lot from Wayne Grudem. I just think in this particular instance, I think that, Dr. Piper is wrong. And since I mentioned Wayne, let me just hasten to add that in Wayne's commentary on ethics, which I would recommend, Politics According to the Bible, that in that particular book, Wayne comes out very forcefully in favor of the Second Amendment and Christians keeping and bearing arms. So you've got two people from the same school of thought in terms of cessation of gifts and that type of thing. And being fairly close, I think both of them would be fairly close theologically. Wayne coming out and taking a diametrically opposed position to that of Dr. Piper.
Now, oh, I'm sorry, did you say...
Well, yeah, in our own, I presume since you're in the PCA that you have some affinity to the Westminster Confession and the catechisms.
I embrace it totally and wholly.
Yes, I'm free to talk about it. That's good.
Yeah.
But, of course, one of the things that is brought up in the catechism is that the requirement of the sixth commandment is to preserve life. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, not just that I would want to protect my family, but I have a biblical obligation to protect life.
Yes. If I may, since you brought that up, what it says in the, you know, the larger catechism was written for pastors. The shorter catechisms for the man and the woman in the pew. And for the listeners who are rolling their eyes now when I talk about catechisms, right, catechism and catechetical instruction is not Roman Catholic. The Roman Catholics actually came about teaching catechisms after the Reformers made such a successful run at it. And the Roman Catholic Church said, wow, these guys are really learning what they believe. And so I'm very, very much of an advocate of Christians reading the confessions and the catechisms on a regular basis. But in the larger catechism in question and answer 135, where it asks, what are the duties required in the Sixth Commandment, it gives this answer. The duties required in the Sixth Commandment are all careful studies and lawful endeavors to preserve the lives of ourselves and others. That's a great start.
Mm-hmm.
Preserve the lives of ourselves and others. So that's one of the reasons I would disagree with Dr. Piper. By resisting all thoughts and purposes, subduing all passions, and avoiding all occasions, temptations, and practices that tend to the unjust taking away the life of any. That's a very interesting point that the divines made. The unjust taking away the life of any. By just defense of life against violence. Patient bearing of the hand of God, quietness of mind, cheerfulness of spirit, the sober use of meat, drink, medicine, sleep, labor, and recreation by charitable thoughts, love, compassion, meekness, gentleness, kindness, peaceable, mild, and courteous speech and behavior, restraint, readiness to be reconciled, patient bearing and forgiving of injuries and repaying good for evil, comforting and relieving the distressed, and protecting and defending the innocent. I mean, you look at the possibilities ethically that you have there with that last phrase.
Yes.
Abortion, your family, protecting the lives of the innocent. If an intruder who is unregenerate or even regenerate breaks into your house, you have no idea why that person is in your house.
And you don't have the time to walk into the living room or the bedroom, wherever you find that person, and say, can we talk? I need to get some answers from you. Why are you here? If you just want to steal my TV, go ahead, that's fine. But if, so I don't have that opportunity. And again, I think Dr. Piper's response is somewhat ivory tower, because again, I believe very, very strongly in the will to live. And that when somebody is attempting to harm me, my wife, or my children, I'm going to put up the best defense I can, the strongest defense I can. And I know, but all the while, I want to qualify that, all the while knowing that my family members will be in heaven when they die. That doesn't mean that we do not use means to prevent them from being attacked.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you have obviously heard the best arguments, well, at least among the best arguments against your position. I know that you were involved in a debate with Michael W. Austin.
Yes.
I think it was a debate that arose from Dr. Piper's public statements.
No, it was actually before that.
Oh, okay.
This happened before, and I was asked by the
Christian Research Institute.
Yes. They asked me if I would be willing to defend my position. And I'm guessing that while Buzz and I are not totally alone, we are somewhat lonely, because they were searching for a PCA pastor who would defend the keeping and bearing of arms. And so I acceded to their request, and when I went on the radio to do that show, I was pleased to hear that after my article was read by my opponent, that he changed his views.
Oh, you mean Michael Austin changed his views?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's what I was told.
Wow, that's interesting. That is very interesting. But what are, if you can think of them, what are the best arguments, Christian arguments, against gun ownership and...
alleged Christian arguments.
Well, those who use the scriptures and Christian morals and ethics,
right,
against loose gun laws.
I think probably for the Christians that the most prevalent arguments that I hear are arguments that are taken from the gospel accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have had this discussion once, I've had it 1,000 times, where I'll be talking with someone about this, and they'll say, yeah, well, what about Matthew 5?
Right, yes.
So there's I think that's the prevalent one, Matthew 5, 38 through 39. And there are all kind of people like John Yoder, who was a pacifist, Jim Wallace, who was a pacifist, Greg Boyd wrote a book called The Myth of a Christian Nation, Glenn Stassen and David Gushee wrote a book called Kingdom Ethics, and they're all talking about how we should not be doing those things. So here's the way the text reads, and I think it's important for our listeners to pay very close attention to what is said, because I want to explain this as I can. Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. All right. So, when I was studying in the village of Compton, in Holland you have to have two minors in addition to your studies, and one of my minors was New Testament, and I was privileged to be the last student of Dr. Herman Ritterbos, who has just written, I think, the classic book on Paul. And the English title is Paul, an Outline of His Theology. And as I was talking to Dr. Ritterbos one day about this particular issue, he said, well, Gleason, you need to pay a closer attention to the text.
And
I said, okay, well, explain to me what's going on. And he says, if I'm facing you and I want to strike you on the right cheek and I am right-handed, how do I do that?
And I said, well, you would have to backhand me. And he said, exactly. And that's what Jesus is talking about there. This is a huge, in Jesus' day, and to a certain extent in our day as well, this is an insult. For somebody to, just to backhand you is an enormous insult. And that's what the Lord is talking about there. And he's saying, if someone insults you, just turn the other cheek to them. Don't pay attention to that insult. And I think what we have to keep in mind when we go to a text like the Sermon on the Mount is that Jesus is correcting a lot of misconceptions in his time. And when we find the refrain, you have heard it said, but I say to you, as Jesus is giving the true interpretation of the law of God, he's putting it into a context where he's talking also about the spiritual interpretation of the law, because in the days of the Lord Jesus, it had come down to the point where the Jews at that time thought, as long as I'm keeping the letter of the law, and I'm good to go. And he's talking more about the whole spirit of that. And so by the time he gets to this section in chapter 5, he's giving us an interpretation. It's not, it does involve literal striking of somebody in the face, but there is a spiritual dimension to this that he's trying to get across to his disciples.
And we have to take our very last break. So if you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, send in an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. We do have a couple of listeners already waiting to have their questions answered. But if you have anything on your mind that you'd like to join them with asking on the air, please write that as soon as you can at chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We're going to be right back with Dr. Ron Gleason. And our topic of discussion, God and Guns, the right and duty of Christians to defend self and family.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Paul Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnson, and by the way, Dr. Gleason, that was the ministry that I was just mentioning to you before, Solid Ground Christian Books. We hope that they get in contact with you and arrange something with you.
That'd be great.
And we are discussing God and Guns, the Christian Right and Duty to Defend Self and Family with Dr. Ron Gleason. The first half hour of the program we had on John R. Lott Jr. to discuss his book, More Guns, Less Crime. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And one of the things that I have personally seen from our brethren in the UK and other places in the world who are theologically identical to us, a number of them think that we here in the States are gun crazy. We are fanatics with guns. We are preoccupied with this. We have this image of reckless cowboy wannabes.
Yeah.
And that this type of machismo being equated with Christianity is really deplorable and so on. What do you have to say to that kind of a thing that I've heard in response to similar programs that I've had, not necessarily on this exact issue, but those that involve gun control laws and so on? If you could...
Sure. I try to give them the benefit of the doubt. I just think they're still bitter about losing the war.
That's why they lost.
Yeah, that's why they lost. Now, actually, it isn't, because in my historical section, as I mentioned earlier, I do talk about the whole idea of the English and the U.S. history on guns. Now, what has happened in England and in other places in Europe as well is that they have been effectively disarmed, and unfortunately, there are pastors who have played along with this, who have played into the hands of the government. So here's my thesis I write about in the book quite a bit. An armed society is a polite society. Mm-hmm. And I believe that part and parcel of our problem, and the problem of the Brits who would complain about us having guns, is the fact that we've watched too many Westerns. And in the Westerns, we get this idea that it was indeed the Wild West. So that, therefore, if we give guns now to law-abiding citizens who pay their taxes, they're going to
they're going to be riding down the freeway one day, and somebody's going to ride by, cut them off, then give them the universal sign of peace and prosperity. And so they're going to take out their 357 and blow them away. That simply doesn't happen. It isn't reality. Whenever we see these mass shootings and everything else, I know that people are longing for the person doing that to be a conservative theologically or politically, or to be a life member of the NRA or Gun Owners of America. But it doesn't happen that way. And Florida, the state of Florida, was a classic test case. In the early 1980s, Florida passed what is called a shall-issue law. And that means that if the person who applied for a concealed carry permit had not been a felon, had not been in a mental institution or anything like that, they were required to, they had to take, I think, a course, 2 or 3 day course, to make sure they could actually hit a target, and they were given the ability to carry their weapons. Well, what everyone predicted in the media was that there would be this enormous gun raid. There were going to be shootings in the street. The streets of Florida were going to be flowing with blood, and the exact opposite occurred. They saw a precipitous drop in rape, assaults, burglaries, and everything else. It's interesting that in comparing Britain to the United States, most of the invasions that of privacy in British homes take place within the home, because the assailants know the Brits are not armed. Most that happen in the United States take place outside the home, because they know that the assailants know that maybe these people have guns in their home, but when they're outside, the government has effectively disarmed the American law-abiding taxpayer. And so those assailants, the assaults, rather, take place outside the home. I think it's an interesting comparison when you look at what's going on. And in Britain now, there was one man who finally did, I guess he managed to hide a shotgun that was supposed to be confiscated. And he protected himself. He'd been burglarized a number of times, and he's in prison for protecting his home and his family. I think it's also interesting that in terms of the greatest dictators that we think of, Mao Zedong, Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Idi Amin, Hussein, what's the first thing they did? They disarmed the citizens. When you look at the Bible, you see, what did the Philistines do with the Israelites? Mm-hmm. Disarmed them. What did the Egyptians do with the Israelites? They disarmed them. So they had no way to protect themselves and to defend themselves. So they were the sheep that were going to be eaten by the wolves.
Is it true that the local bobby on the streets of England is not even carrying a gun, the local policeman?
I think they're rethinking that one because of some of the attacks that they have had recently. But yes, that is true. They don't carry firearms.
Now,
again, I think they're rethinking that position in light of current events.
Now, some would say that would be a sign or an evidence that guns are not necessary to deter crime, because they would say that the crime rate here in the major cities of the United States is much greater than that that occurs in England. How do you comment on that?
Yeah, John Lott's book is I think very, very helpful on that, because it deals with the whole idea of statistics. And within the context of statistics, when, for example, and I deal with this in the manuscript, you have a number of people who will say that guns in the hands of young people, you see this huge spike in terms of violence. Now, what they don't tell you is that guns in the hands of the young people, according to these statistical analyses, involve gangs. Well, yeah. If you have gangs out on the streets shooting each other, doing drive-by shootings and doing all of the things they have to do to get initiated into the gang, go out and murder some random person, yeah, then you're going to see a spike in the death by by guns. But the statistics, and that's just one of the many places where John Watt's book is so helpful, because John breaks that down so well and shows us that that's just not the case. I'm going to probably be politically incorrect here, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway, because it's common sense, it's truth, and it needs to be said. Unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of gun violence in the United States is in the cities where they have the most stringent gun laws. So, for example, Detroit, Chicago, New York, all of the big cities where there are gun controls on top of gun controls, you have this, and by and large, not totally, but by and large, it is black-on-black crime. And it's usually about drugs or turf or both. And that's, and unfortunately, I take no joy in saying that. That just happens to be the cold hard fact.
I remember going years ago, many years ago, to a fundraiser for Alan Keyes when he was running for president. And I remember he had a great answer to a question from the audience when somebody said, "Why are you so opposed to gun control laws?" He quoted Lord Acton from the 19th century, "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely."
Unless we're talking about God.
Excuse me?
Unless we're talking about God.
Yes, right. And the fact of the matter is, it's always a dangerous thing to have a minority of people who are in leadership, who are in power in any given country, to have all the guns. I mean, when you think about it, it makes absolutely perfect sense.
Well, it does. And when you stop and think about all the people today, I mean, we're in this election cycle right now. The people today that are out campaigning and are campaigning against the Second Amendment, and there are many who have said that they will do away with guns. Both of our senators out here in California want to do away with guns. They make a big point about assault weapons and all of this. But all of those people are surrounded by people with guns.
Yes.
So it's not as if they don't want people to have guns. They just don't want some people to have guns, and they want to be the ones who determine who has them and who does not have them. Their families are protected, but when it comes down to our families, the best we have is hand-to-hand combat, and you better be really good at it. Because I've heard the old adage, it's not wise to take a knife to a gunfight. It's usually not too wise to take a hand to a gunfight either.
We have another listener in White Plains, New York, Bob, who says, "Do you know if there is any correlation to the strict ban on guns in England and the rise of extreme fundamentalist Islam in England, where they realize there will be less of a serious threat to them using strength and power there?"
Yeah, well, that makes psychological sense, doesn't it? If someone believes that the most you can muster against them will be a kitchen knife, and they have an AK-47, those are great odds. One radio interview a while back. We have a requirement here in California that for a handgun or for a rifle, the most rounds you're able to have is 10. 9 in the magazine, 1 in the chamber. And a woman called in and she asked, "Well, why would anybody need more than 10 rounds?" And I said, "Well, that's a great question. So here's the scenario. You hear something that goes bump in the night. Your husband's out of town. You get up and you call 911. And I tried to explain to her the best way to go to the top of the list in a 911 call is to call 911 and to say, "I'm locked in my room, and this is my address. I'm in my bedroom. Here's where the bedroom is located. There's somebody in my house. I am armed, and if they try to break down the door and come through the door, I am going to shoot them." You will go to the top of the list
yes.
immediately. But the other part of it is, so I said to this woman, "Okay, you've got 10 rounds. you hear something goes bump in the night, you walk out with your gun in your hand, and there are two 200-pound men in your living room. They are not law-abiding citizens. They are criminals by definition, which means they don't obey the law. Each of them has a handgun containing at least 30 rounds. Do you like those odds? And I think those are the things that kind of boils down to. I don't like the notion, and I don't think, I'm convinced that our founding fathers, had they had the opportunity to fire more than one round in very quick succession, is that they would not have put a limit on, well, you can only have 10 rounds. And again, it's just putting the law-abiding citizen at a decided disadvantage. If a criminal has a magazine with 100 rounds and you've got 10, I don't like that, because you've got to stop and you've got to reload if you survive that long.
There are liberals, and perhaps not even people that are consistently liberal. They may even be conservative on other areas. The Amish and the Mennonite communities are very conservative, and even sometimes bordering on or exceeding the lines of cultic when it comes to strict moral codes and so on. But they will be people who are pacifist. And but going back to my point, though, there are people who say that we, who are very much in favor of loosening gun control laws and in favor of law-abiding citizens owning guns, that when we use the whole militia concept from the Second Amendment, and we use the idea that we can never allow any government to be in control of all of the firearms, that we are being ridiculous in thinking that our government is going to become like Nazi Germany did or something like that, and that we as citizens are going to overthrow such a government, that this is just a ridiculous science fiction evil fantasy of the future that will never happen, and that we're fear-mongering and that kind of a thing. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think that's a really sound argument. The only drawback is that the history of the world militates against that. That there, Nazi Germany never, in its wildest imagination, the people that lived there thought they would become Nazi Germany. And the same thing is true of the history of the world. The history of the world has been one of oppression and slavery for those who are willing to take the time to investigate it. That's why when we have these nations, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, they were called that because that was the word for slaves. And the same thing would be true of biblical history. When you look at what was going on in biblical history, there's a history of slavery and there's a history of oppression. And rather than trying to take a rose-colored look at these things, I tried, as a Christian pastor, to take the notion of sin and depravity very seriously. Sometimes sin and depravity is blatant and open. At other times, it's hidden. It's camouflaged. It's oblique. But it's there. It's always roiling under the surface, and sometimes it roils in a manner that is frightening. And so I try to be a realist when it comes to this. I own guns. It is my concerted prayer every day that I would never have to use that gun to take a human life. I think that would just be very, very hard to do. However, I also believe that it's important for us and for the Amish, and of course, who have this long history of pacifism, to sit down and to deal with the reality of what would happen if somebody came to assault you and your family. How does that scenario play out? Are you just going to call 911? Are you just going to pray about it? Or are you going to do something that is more proactive and try to protect your family? For me, it's going to be the latter. I've thought this through as a Christian. I see no biblical prohibition whatsoever to defending myself and to defend my family. If I can get away from a situation like that, if I could run away, even if I had a firearm and not have to fire a shot, I'd do it. I would try to avoid that as much as I could. But if it came right down to it, I would do it. And organizations like Gun Owners of America and the NRA have published so many statistics that point us, and it depends on who you read, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 million times a year, law-abiding citizens simply brandish a gun. They never fire a shot. And what happens is the assailants turn and run. I found in the military that the hardest thing to teach a soldier was to run towards the gunfire. It is counterintuitive. And so if you watch any of these episodes of Cops or any of these other shows at night, you see these armed thugs come into a store or wherever else, and the other person has a gun and start shooting. I don't care how heavily armed they are. They duck and cover, and they run. So the reason they do that is because they are thugs, and they are preying on what they consider to be the innocent, the unarmed. And if I am convinced that it is a deterrent, that if someone thinks for one moment, if I walk into a bank and I'm going to rob the bank and there are 15 people in there and maybe 10 of those people are armed and could fire back, they'll think twice about it. They may still go ahead and do it, but they may walk out. If they are able to walk out, they're going to be heavier when they're carried out because they're going to have lead poisoning.
Yep.
And CJ from Lindenhurst, Long Island, wants to know, have you ever heard of Stephen P. Halbrook's book, Gun Control in the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and, quote, Enemies of the State?
I have not read that book by Stephen, but I have a number of his books, and I highly recommend his book, too. He has one called The Founder's Second Amendment, The Origins of the Right to bear arms. I have that quoted in my book. Then he has another book that's called That Every Man Be Armed, The Evolution of a Constitutional Right. Halbrook is a very, very knowledgeable writer, and I think he's Gary Kleck is another one that I depend on quite a bit. David Koppel is also very, very good. And there's a woman named Joyce Malcolm who has a book called Guns and Violence and to Keep and Bear Arms. She's a Brit, and she was very helpful to me in my research as I was dealing with the background in England of gun rights.
We have an anonymous listener who wants to know if you can recommend a gun that is best for a slightly built woman.
Yes. So anonymous, here is my tip of the day. If you are slightly built, you don't want a handgun, for example, that has a great deal of recoil, because that will be scary. So I would consider a 9mm. Or, I guess it's okay to give some, I would say a Beretta, and I give that one because that's what my wife has. She has a Beretta 9. And the other one would probably be a Smith & Wesson, small Smith & Wesson 38. So those are both, and they will feel good in your hand. Yes. There will be less recoil because they're somewhat heavy.
And her second question is, can I have Reverend Buzz's address?
You're popular, Buzz.
Yes. While we're on the subject of are you familiar, just I have to ask you this, but because I was just in preparation for the program today, I listened to it again. But are you familiar with I believe it was in 1991, the Bonson-Atwood debate over gun control?
Yes, I am. It took place out here in Southern Cal, in Irvine, near where I am right now.
Yes, yes. I thought that was just tremendous.
Well, I was honored and privileged to have known Greg. I was actually at the hospital the day he died.
Wow.
Pastors don't often get visits, so I tried to be a pastor to the pastors at times.
Wonderful.
And it's just amazing when I listen to, you know, he was debating a liberal Presbyterian minister, and in the course of that debate, the Presbyterian minister was just fabricating things. And I, I'm not trying to ascribe false motives to the Presbyterian minister, but he probably got those off of some off-the-wall website.
Oh, yeah.
And he was citing, I think he cited that, you know, 1 month out here, something like 13,000 people had been killed.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's just, it was amazing. But that's the kind of disinformation. For whatever I think about the anti-gun movement, they have done their indoctrination fairly well, because they have promoted so much disinformation. There's so much fear mongering that goes that it's not even remotely funny.
I don't know if you guys remember a very, very funny episode of All in the Family in the 1970s, where Archie Bunker is invited onto a local news program to give response from a listener. And he was talking about, one of the things he was talking about was how to stop hijacking of airplanes. And his first comment was, well, I would end the hijacking tomorrow. First, you got to arm all your passengers. And I remember the audience erupting with a roarious laughter. And although I don't think it would be a good idea to actually give firearms to passengers that are getting on a plane, but what do you think? Are there any places where you think it's inappropriate for people to legally carry on guns with them? Is there any place?
I would probably, in the case of airlines, when you arm a whole bunch of people and there's something going on in an airplane in particular, if everybody does not have frangible ammunition, but even if they do, the danger of crossfire is imminent. And so I if you could replay the 9/11 scenario when the hijackers were on the plane, if while they're taxiing out, you got to go through that whole rigmarole of, you know, listening to the safety instructions, and to have the cabin attendant say words to this effect: "We welcome aboard our sky marshals and all of our law enforcement personnel on the plane who are all armed. We also want to remind you that the captain and the co-captain are former Air Force, and they are also armed. So just sit back, ladies and gentlemen, and enjoy your flight." I think there would have been a very different scenario that would have played itself out. For the rest, though, I mean, the predators will prey on areas where they're convinced that people who do have concealed carry permits are not allowed to carry. Post office, certain workplaces. I know that a lot of workplaces, the people are just afraid of guns, and there's no need to be afraid of a law-abiding citizen with a gun. And schools and things of that nature. I'm one of these people who's all in favor of training teachers to be armed and to carry in the classroom, especially in this day and age.
Sure.
In the transportation industry, they do not allow guns.
Yeah. I mean, and churches. I mean, you stop and think about what Buzz does and what I do. It's how many times have we read about someone walking in and just walking up and shooting the pastor, walking in and shooting the congregants?
Well, I don't know if you heard the story that an anonymous listener from Alabama emailed, but he said that he asked a pastor friend if you pack a gun, and the pastor said yes. And he said, if an intruder came into your congregation and began shooting people, what would you do? He said, I would duck behind the pulpit. And he goes, why on earth would you do that? And he goes, because I don't want to get hit by the crossfire. Everybody in my congregation is packing.
Well, that really does raise a very good and interesting point. I think that every congregation ought to have something in place to deal with an active shooter. Obviously, if you have law enforcement personnel in your congregation. You know, there are only two nations in the world that allow law enforcement personnel to carry off duty: Israel and the United States. So if you had something like that, it would behoove the pastor and the leadership in the church to sit down and have a very workable plan where the people would be protected. The hardest thing that would happen, if somebody came in and started shooting, it doesn't matter how much you practice it, people are going to panic.
And we're out of time. And if you could give your website one more time for our listeners.
It's one word, gracepresbyterian.net.
GracePresbyterian.net. Thank you so much, Dr.
Thank
Ron
you, Chris.
Grayson.
Thanks, Buzz.
Thank you.
And
so
I look
much.
Forward to having you back on the program, God willing, next Monday, March 7th.
Looking forward to it.
I Thank want you. Everybody to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. We look forward to receiving your questions for our guests tomorrow on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. God bless.